Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Thank you for joining me for today's SMIE Consulting Midweek Roundup. Today, our live chat is going to consist of three top issues that we've come across our news feeds in the last 7 days. We'll be taking a look at some familiar issues for those of you who've been on previous midweek roundups, but we're also going to take a new look at some issues that have recently appeared. And shed a little different light on what is happening in the world of international education. So hopefully you'll be able to contribute with your comments and questions throughout today's midweek roundup. And we're glad you're here and hope to have a fruitful discussion today. As always, I'm your host, Marty Bennett, president and founder of Social Media and International Education Consulting. And today we're going to look at three issues. One, India and student employment, and we're going to look at that from two different ways, the one that you're probably used to and the one that will be news in terms of how it's being talked about. We'll also look at China and the scandals and the spying claims that have been going back and forth over the last few weeks, coming to a head recently with some testimony by the FBI director on Capitol Hill. And finally, we'll wrap up with one of my favorite topics, test optional policies for international students, particularly for undergraduate SAT, ACT test optional policies. So we'll look at those three issues and more. For those of you who are new to the Midweek Roundup, each Wednesday at 1 p.m. Eastern, we take a look at three issues that have popped onto our news feeds over the last few days and go a little bit more in depth as to what these stories actually mean and the implications potentially for U.S. Institutions. We look not only at what's happening in the United States, but we'll look at other countries as well, either destination markets for international students to see how other countries are dealing with potential student issues, as well as other countries, source countries for the United States and their impacts on our markets, given events that are happening in those countries. So we're really looking forward to your contributions today for this lively topic, lively topics that we'll be discussing today. For those of you who aren't familiar with social media and international ed consulting, I started the company about 5 years ago when I left Education USA and have used this platform, particularly in the last year, to really start reaching out to colleagues in international ed through social media channels and otherwise, to keep them informed as to what some of the major issues are that I'm seeing from a 10,000 foot view, and then sharing some opportunities to use some of the knowledge that you're learning through these stories to help improve or refine what you're already doing on campus. We do that first through our website, smieconsulting.org, but also a lot of free resources there, but also through our weekly newsletter in addition to this midweek roundup live chat. The newsletter comes out Monday mornings at 9 o'clock a.m. Eastern, compiling my takes on 10 to 15 international ed stories, as well as 4 or 5 social media stories that can impact what you do in international education. So we're really glad that you can make use of both our website, this midweek roundup, and hopefully our newsletter as well. Feel free to subscribe to that newsletter. I've just put the links to the website and the most recent edition of the newsletter, and we call that all the SMIE news fit to share. So we encourage you to get those, get that subscription signed up, and free subscription to all my colleagues in international ed. We use 3 of the stories from that newsletter on Monday to form the foundation of what we talk about today on the Midweek Roundup. So let's get right into the first story on India and the issue of student employment and opportunities for post-study work, which we all know, anyone who's done any work with Indian students, both at the prospective stage or while there are students on your campus, you look at what really drives them, and certainly work is an important part of their initial search for institutions in the United States, or just the United States as a destination in and of itself, is what are their chances to work, not only on campus, but off campus, either through practical training opportunities or H-1B eventually. So we all know that work, when it comes to Indian students, is a very significant piece of their journey while they're in the United States. And what individual institutions do to help accommodate that, the more the merrier in terms of how these students will be received and receptive to what you have to say about your institution. So what is happening that brought this issue again to light? Well, for those who know that what we do here on the Roundup is we look at a variety of different sources for international ed news. And I really make an effort to not just go to Inside Higher Ed and chronicle stories every week, because there are certainly great stories that have come out, but they may be amalgamations of other smaller stories, and that's great too. But I certainly look a little bit further afield for the kinds of stories that maybe shed some light on how international ed related topics are being viewed in non-industry publications. So this one in particular is from a newsletter for Indian Americans called the Indian Panorama. And it is titled Indian Envoy Advocates for Nurturing H-1B Visa as Mutually Beneficial Partnership. This particularly talks about the U.S. ambassador, or the India's ambassador to the United States, Harsh Vardhan Shringla, and that's his emphasis in this article and in this talk is related to H-1B. As we talked about from the top, that's an extremely high priority. There's a lot of historical ties between the tech industry in the United States and the development of India's Silicon Valley and in Bangalore and Hyderabad, or Bengaluru, I should say, and Hyderabad. So we look at these kinds of relationships, and certainly the data on H-1B visa holders. Currently, the lion's share, greater majority, are Indian origin. There has been some talk in higher ed circles and immigration circles as to, and certainly the administration has seen fit to look at that process as part of its review of its broader immigration strategies and look to tweak the way H-1Bs are awarded. There's also been a lot of evidence recently that that process, H-1B process, a lot of RFEs have delayed processing on H-1Bs, particularly for students going on to from OPT to H-1B, from their F to H. So that is certainly an issue, but the ambassador here focuses on what has been the primary route for Indians to H-1B, and that has been what I've certainly found out in the last year that I didn't know already, is that the greater majority of the H-1Bs that India receives are ones that come direct from India. These are because of relationships in the tech industry and subsidiaries or partnerships or offices in India that maybe have U.S. Mother companies or parent companies that will have employees from India come to work at their facilities in the United States on H-1B, so coming direct from India to work in the U.S. That has been where the majority of Indians currently on H-1Bs in the United States have come, and that is why the ambassador here focuses on this as part of his push to nurture that H-1B relationship. But those who know and have followed the Midweek Roundup and international ed news of the last few months know that the current administration is changing the way H-1Bs are allocated. Those that know that there's a 65,000 cap plus an additional 20,000 a year currently for advanced degree holders from the United States. Those who do masters or doctorates in the United States, there's 20,000 kind of set aside for them. And the indication is that that's changing to where the lion's share of that 65,000 for Indians, as far as Indians have been concerned, have gone to those that are coming direct from India. The chances are now that that proportion will be swinging in favor of those that have gotten advanced degrees in the United States. And that seemed to be the priority, where it would be flipped on its head, so to speak, where the priority of that first 65,000 would be for advanced degree holders from the United States. So Indians that have come to the U.S. to study and then are then applying after OPT for H-1B through their employers are ones that are probably going to be more likely to get H-1Bs in the future if this new policy does stay in place. So that's certainly why the Indian ambassador is certainly focusing on that. He does also highlight, in beyond just talking about the IT industry relationship with U.S. In terms of employees coming over directly, he also does talk about the Indian students' contribution to the U.S. economy and refers back to a lot of the data we know from the NAFSA Economic Impact Statement that breaks down 39 billion plus per year in economic impact of international students overall to the United States. The ambassador relates a figure of $7.5 billion just from Indian students to the U.S. economy. That and then also says students in the U.S. who go on to work in H-1Bs also spur innovation and entrepreneurship, he pointed out. So with the lion's share of Indian students pursuing STEM, 85% of which, according to the ambassador, and that's certainly in line with roughly the numbers I've seen over the last few years from Sivas by the Numbers and Open Doors. So that certainly reflects well on what I think the data would share. So this is certainly a priority for India, but there's also the other side of the coin with this article. You may have seen a couple of weeks ago we had an article in the newsletter and highlighted it briefly on the roundup that India is now pushing into becoming a destination for international students, a major destination for international students, not just a center, much like their peer in Asia, China, which is already the number one center of students abroad in the world. And also is increasingly becoming, I think, the top three or four as a destination for international students. India wants a piece of that too, because they see obviously the benefits to their institutions and their economy as well. So what does that look like? So we talked last week about a new policy or a new proposal that they're going to commit 50 odd million dollars in the upcoming budget to create world-class universities. And he thinks it's going to take a lot more than just that to do that in India, as to make them hubs or destinations for international students to come to India for studies, for degrees in particular. Certainly looking at the China model, there were huge, a lot, in fact, not greater, well, not a greater majority, but a good proportion of the international students in China now are on short-term summer programs or semester programs, not necessarily full degrees. And that's probably where the Indian market will start. There may have to be scholarships involved in certain places as well. But one of the important elements that I think they recognize, the Indian Ministry overseeing human resource development in that country has seen, and according to this Pi News article that I'll share the link with now, is their focus is adding in work benefits, so work rights to the existing visa scheme, which currently does not provide for work permission for international students that study in India now. So that's something that, as they realize, that their students, when they go abroad, particularly the US, UK, Australia, want that ability to work. They're looking to put some sort of provisions in place with the visa within the visa scheme to allow that for international students that come to India. So the importance of work is always top of mind for international students, so it should be no surprise there, and certainly for Indians to now acknowledge that they need to do that for their own, for international students that are coming there. If they want to be considered a serious destination for international students, that's certainly going to be an important piece of that puzzle. So Indian, keep your eyes focused on that. That'll be certainly a developing story in the weeks and months to come, as how India kind of comes out on the international ed stage to become more of a destination market. We'll see what else happens there on the work front. Now, shifting gears to China, we all have heard the stories of certainly the stories of Confucius Institutes that have been closing in the United States on U.S. college campuses for a variety of reasons. From academic freedom and to control of those institutions of those institutes by Chinese government officials and organizations connected to the Chinese government, and the impact of that on free academic expression and that type of thing. Those have been covered here on the roundup. We've also talked in the past about how U.S. institutions are now falling victim to some of the spying concerns or intellectual property theft that's happening in the United States at U.S. institutions, but also companies and other U.S. enterprises. So there's been a lot of those stories recently, but until I read this story from I was in the VOA, Voice of America, this past week regarding testimony the FBI director Christopher Wray gave. That's the title of this article is China, the main culprit in intellectual property theft probe. Director Wray has indicated in his testimony that the FBI has more than 1,000 active investigations into attempted theft of U.S. intellectual property, with nearly all involving China. This was on Tuesday this past week, where that he's indicated that China is the number one counterintelligence threat to the United States. So that's obviously significant. That's the first time I'd heard anything beyond anecdotal stories of something professors at Emory or at other institutions that have been let go as a result of potential spying investigations or leaks or improper due diligence on the part of the U.S. institution related to Chinese professors, researchers, scholars that were working with the scholars of that institution in the United States. So it's going to be really one to keep an eye on here, and with the related to these spying scandals. The testimony that Director Wray gave, certainly there's a lot of corporate espionage implied here, but on the university campus side, Director Wray does kind of pick out universities for some criticism here, where he says the Chinese have created pipelines at U.S. universities that allow them to steal and funnel to China key intellectual property for the advancement of its various strategic plans. And that's something that really is going to be an issue moving forward, and certainly with this administration's stance on China and the trade wars that are going on. We've talked about the visa delays that have happened for renewals of Chinese students and scholars that are in STEM fields, particularly for this reason, to nip in the bud and be absolutely circumspect about the nature of their research in the United States and their programs, to make sure that they are all on the up and up. So there's certainly been overreactions and overreaching in on the visa side, in particular for returning students, because of this issue. But it's one that this administration takes very seriously, and obviously with 1,000 active investigations, nearly all of which are involving China, that's something that we can't ignore as higher ed institutions. So the impact on international student and scholar offices, and the due diligence that the individual departments who are employing these the scholars and these students for research are certainly going to be under increased scrutiny, more so than they already are, and will be down to the institutions to really put in place the kind of procedures and reviews and particular employment practices and reviews of those in place that will prevent, will meet certainly administration guidelines, which will be the driving force of whether they will receive future ones or have visas approved for future scholars. So be interesting to keep an eye out on this one, because that will be, I think, will have a lot of legs, and certainly in the press. Now, related to this on China, we've alluded to some of this before when we talked earlier in the spring about the Varsity Blues scandal that broke, and the implications, obviously, in U.S. circles has gotten so much play, and we found out that we've learned that there's going to be a Lifetime channel or one of the other cable channels is going to be doing a movie, a made-for-TV movie about this issue, about the college admissions scandals. But there is also an international aspect to these scandals, admission scandals. One of which didn't get a lot of press at the time back in March when this first when the indictments first came down, but a Chinese woman who was indicted in March in California for faking U.S. student visa documents for 2,600 students who paid her to extend their visas. When we say visas, a lot of times when non-industry press cover these, they don't really get their terminology right. But these were student visa holders who were at the end of their OPT, maybe looking to apply for H-1B. And she's based in California, but it's a Bloomberg article that covers that. And I'll certainly place the link to that in the live stream so that you have it for your reference here. It certainly covers a lot of ground here in this article, but in terms of the students that were involved, this received over $2 million from students seeking fraudulent paperwork to qualify for visa extensions, according to the indictment. She would be advertising in China and North American websites on WeChat as well. Her particular focus was for these F1 students who are finishing their OPT looking to apply for H-1B. So she would be faking job offer letters, payroll records, tax forms, all that as part of that process. So there are a number of students from universities in Chicago that were unidentified which university, but that the students were not charged, but the certainly she was the kind of the ringleader of this this stream. So it'll be interesting to see how these kind of stories also impacting policy. Again, bad eggs that kind of spoil it for everyone else. Is that going to be the case? Certainly that seems to be what has happened with government policy on how increasingly the institutions are going to be regulated related to employment of Chinese scholars and students in research fields that are STEM programs in particular, where there's a fear of intellectual property theft. So we'll certainly be keeping an eye on that. So those bad eggs, so to speak, do often spoil it for others. So whether it's on the student visa front, fraudulent documents, that type of thing rings, that where it's one person but who impacted 2,600 students at the end of their visas. So that's an issue there. There's the cases where intellectual property theft has actually occurred, and that has gone back to China. That's something that will be under increased scrutiny, and it's certainly unfortunate because as we've talked about on the roundup before, we don't like broad strokes, broad brushing cultures and countries based on the actions of a few, and that's something that we really need to get our heads around and certainly advocate with our elected officials about. Related to policy that shouldn't be based on individual or small number of cases, but certainly when there's documented fraud, certainly that needs to be nipped in the bud. So we'll see what happens with that one. Now, last topic we'll talk about today is one I've certainly mentioned before on the roundup in different as different institutions have been highlighted and really celebrated for going test optional, whether it was the University of Chicago last year, and there's just been a recent piece in Inside Higher Ed about how they've declared their switch to test optional as a highly selective institution to be very much a success, and how that's increased their diversity of their incoming class and all the kind of objectives that they had set out initially. But all too often, these test optional policies do not include international students. So I've talked before about the 1,000 or so institutions that are on the fairtest.org site that are listed as test optional. Of that number, less than a third are also international test optional, where freshman incoming first-year students do not have to take SAT or ACT. So the issues and I've always said, well, why would you require an SAT or an ACT test of an international student for whom that exam is not designed at all and is specifically for U.S. students in U.S. high schools learning American English? That if you're going to be in a position where you say the SAT, ACT is not okay for your domestic students because it isn't a fair test, because it is disadvantaging students who do not have the resources to take test prep classes and do all the necessary things they need to do well on the SAT or ACT. If it's not okay for your own students in the United States, why would it be okay for international students, so who are even less prepared for this kind of an exam? So that's always been my position on international students and SAT, ACT, that they should be exempt from that. When selective institutions start making fine lines. Obviously, they have very fine lines that they make when they have many more applicants than they have positions for, whether admission rates are less than 10% for all the Ivies, as well as Stanford and University of Chicago and others. They can afford to be that selective, and then they're looking for those fine distinctions. But again, it's often to the detriment of international applicants for whom those tests are not well designed. So what is this article and this latest one from Inside Higher Ed talks about this phenomenon and addresses finally Elizabeth Redden, always one of my favorite international ed reporters, has finally brought it up to be test optional or not to be for international students. So and she talks about the trend, increased trend towards becoming test optional for domestic students. And she makes the clear point that I've always made, just because a college is test optional doesn't mean it's optional for international students. So obviously it's a very confusing process for international students as it is. And in most countries, there's one test you take at the end of high school, and that determines what institutions you get into. Those tests certainly are not the same here in the United States. There is not one single test you take, and it's a very individualized process by institution. And when there are 4,000 plus institutions, it's a mind-boggling task for an international student, particularly a first-year student, to undertake by themselves. Certainly, there's a lot of people out there that want to help, but the institutional policies really don't help universities in this respect, or to help their prospective students in that respect. So there are students like Bucknell who announced their new test optional policy this past week, and Elizabeth focuses on them in the article, that they will continue to require SAT or ACT scores from international applicants. And what their dean of admissions describes as credential verification purposes. Not sure that that means, what that means, credential verification, verifying that what their high school transcripts are based on an SAT or an ACT score. Absolutely atrocious comment there. Don't think that that's relevant and certainly applicable to what international students are going through. His further comment is, when I think about the admissions landscape, we know that there are some areas where you have to be careful about the academic credentials you've received in terms of is what is being provided to you and as an institution, how a student is actually performing. Certainly that's a concern that I certainly am well aware of, and as a director of international admissions have done that. I've always been concerned about credential verification, but SAT and ACTs don't do that. And that's because those are two completely different things. You verify the credentials that you get. That's the most important piece. If you're using that as what you need to verify, verify that that's actually a real credential first. The SAT or ACT does not do that because that's not what they're designed to do. So this is something that we really want to, I certainly think, is an important piece of the puzzle. University of Denver had announced their new test optional policy in March, where they have actually said, and with whom I certainly have a lot of affection for the staff at the University of Denver and admissions and international admissions in particular, and certainly know the folks there well. And the university previously required SAT or ACT only for those international applicants who attended American-style schools. And I get that. That makes more sense. And they say for those that don't, which would have been the lion's share of their international undergrad applicants, it just didn't make, quote-unquote, it didn't make sense to require a U.S.-centric exam for students studying under a completely different system. So that's important. My alma mater, Marquette, is also referenced in this article. They announced test optional for domestic students in June. They had always been test optional for SAT, ACT. When I worked there in the 90s, certainly they were test optional for SAT, ACT, but they said that they had been test optional for international applicants for the past 2 years. I think it's a lot longer than that, since the director of undergrad admissions at Marquette said the policy is only possible because of the expertise Marquette's international office has developed in assessing international credentials. So I think that speaks well to the reputation that Marquette has and the international office has there, which is a separate office from domestic admissions. So glad to see that that's happening, and that hopefully more institutions will get on the bandwagon here and realize that SAT, ACT is really not the mark standard that you certainly want to be using for credential evaluation for your international applicants. So thanks again for joining me today for this week's Midweek Roundup. Please do remember to subscribe to the newsletter at smaeconsulting.org. and go to the subscribe page, and you'll be able to get the link to that subscription. And look forward to hearing from you again in the weeks to come, and look forward to seeing you out at future conferences. To my colleagues at the EdUSA Forum, celebrating their 10th anniversary of the Forum this week, I was there for the first four, and certainly grateful to have been a part of that, and so happy to see it still thriving and flourishing in its after 10 years. So congratulations to you all, and hope the Forum is a rousing success for you. Have a wonderful week. Catch you next time.